Good morning and welcome back to Nachyomi. Today we're going to be focusing on Yirmiyahu Perek Nun Beis, the 52nd and last Perek of Yirmiyahu. This is an incredible achievement because if you are listening to this and have been through Sefer Yirmiyahu, that means to say that we've been through 52 prakim, which is essentially going at 5 prakim a week, is the span of over 10 weeks. This is almost 3 months of work. And it's an incredible amount of achievement. So really a great Yashar Kochachem, a great congratulations to those who are up to this point. This last Perek, as the Abar Benel points out, is in fact potentially added on by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, by the last Nevi'im, at the end of Yirmiyahu, because it sounds like at the end of Perek Nun Aleph, it's the end of the prophecies of Yirmiyahu. Nonetheless, it is actually very similar to the end of Seif Melachim Beis, Perek Chav Dalet to Chav Hei. We see actually parts of this are mentioned earlier on in Lamed Tes in Sefer Yirmiyahu itself. It's really a historical review of the times of destruction. So the first section in Aleph to Gimel reminds us of an overview of Tzidkiyahu HaMelech, the last king of Yehuda, who was Tzidkiyahu HaMelech. He was 21 years old when he took the throne. His mother's name was Chamutal, Bas Yirmiyahu Milivna, the daughter of another Yirmiyahu from Livna. And the Tanakh tells us pretty unequivocally, Vayas hara b'einei Hashem k'chol asher asa Yehoyakim, and he did evil in the eyes of Hashem like Yehoyakim did. And he rebelled against Babel. Now that's pretty strong language. Yehoyakim was a bad king. But Tzidkiyahu, we've seen that Chazal have described that Tzidkiyahu was a great man, and in fact he saved his generation to a certain degree. It was the bad people in the generation. So what the Malbim suggests is that, you know what, what the Pasuk is emphasizing over here is that he was bad as a function of the fact that he was not strong enough to stand up to bad people, which is sad. But unfortunately, in the position of leadership, a person has a responsibility not to bend in front of those types of people. That's what he is being indicted for in the longitudinal perspective. Then the Tanakh goes on to describe the capture of Tzidkiyahu and his unfortunate demise. It was in the ninth year, in the tenth month, on the tenth of the month. So that's the tenth of Teves. That's when Nebuchadnezzar returns and besieges the city. They make this siege around, the siege platform around Yerushalayim, and they kept it essentially for 2.5 years. So the reason why we fast Asara B'Teves is because the beginning of the siege, which lasted these 2.5 years all the way through to the time of Tisha B'Av, 2 years later, which is when the city was finally destroyed. And that's what the Pasuk says, that Bachodesh HaRevi'i B'Tisha B'Chodesh V'Yechezak Ra'av Ba'ir. You can imagine this is really more than two plus years of no food, no water coming into the city. At this point in time, it was so bad, the famine was so bad that there was nothing for anybody to eat, and that's when the resistance paled. That's when they were able to get into the city, and the breach was made on the 9th of Tammuz. We know that the 9th of Tammuz is not the day we commemorate the breach. We commemorate the breach on the 17th of Tammuz, either because that was in the second term, basically, the breach was on the 17th, or it's because it was the start or end of the process of the Gomorrah and Tanis suggests. But nonetheless, either way, it started in Tammuz, and by the time that Av rolled round, we know that the custom, the Babylonians entered the city and Nebuchadnezzar came in. At this point in time, when Tzidkiyahu sees them, he immediately runs. He has a special passageway, which takes him out to Arvor Siricho, the area of the desert by Jericho. But he was captured by the custom when he emerges from the cave. And we saw in Parak Lamentes, how Rashi suggests that a deer came to run in front of the Babylonians and showed their way to the entrance of the cave, which was as Tzidkiyahu was emerging, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted it to be, he told Tzidkiyahu, if you surrender, you'll be fine. If you don't surrender, you won't be fine. He did not surrender, and he was not fine. He was brought in front of Nebuchadnezzar in Rivla, which is where the encampment was, and Vaydaber Itoyim Mishpatim, he spoke to him about judgment. Meaning to say, there was a court martial which was being held for Tzidkiyahu. What was the court martial? So, if you look at if you contrast this to Melachim Beis, the very end in Perek Chof Hei there, when it talks about, it says, Vaydaber Ito Ish Mishpat, they talked to him about justice. So the Malbim points out that there were two concerns. One concern is the fact that Tzidkiyahu had made an oath to Nebuchadnezzar not to rebel against him, and he broke that oath. So they were taking him to court, essentially about his reneging on his commitment. But at the same time, Vaydaber Ito Mishpatim, which is said over here, sounds like it's one person speaking, not many people, and it's about Mishpatim, about many things. So Rashi quotes an interesting chazal, which is that there was actually a personal vendetta here as well, which is that Tzidkiyahu had seen Nebuchadnezzar do something which embarrassed Nebuchadnezzar, and that was that for whatever reason he was eating an Arneves Chaya, he was eating a live hare for a particular purpose. And he was so embarrassed that Tzidkiyahu saw him this way that he asked him not to reveal it. And Tzidkiyahu let the cat out of the bag, which means that there was a personal vendetta as much as there was also a national justice which was being sought out of. Here you see this in the two ways of this being described. And what he does is most terribly and horribly is he kills all his children in front of him. He kills the Sarei Yehuda in front of them. And then he blinded him and put him into chains and brought him to Babel. This is a complete humiliation. This is, you can imagine what will does he have to live after this. Very terrible situation for Tzidkiyahu HaMelech. And then the psukim go on from Yud Beis all the way through to Chof Gimel to describe in specific detail the destruction of Yerushalayim, the Beis HaMikdash, and the whole area. In fact, it says there's three descriptions of what was destroyed. Well, Yisrov is Beis Hashem, he burnt the house of Hashem. There's Beis HaMelech, the palace of the king. There's Kol Batei Yerushalayim, all the houses of Yerushalayim, which the Mephoreshim mean to say the more illustrious, the palatial homes in Yerushalayim. There's Kol Beis HaGadol Saraf Ba'esh, and every big house was destroyed. What is every big house? Rashi says either it means to say it is a Beis Knesses, every shul, which we Megadlim Bohem Tefillah, that there's Tefillah grows in them, or Bata Midrash, Shem Megadlim Bohem HaSatorah, or it means the Bata Midrash, they were all destroyed. Well, this sort of takes me back to thinking about is Lahavdil, but you know, when the Jordanians, the Arab Legion, took control of the old city in the War of Independence in 1948, and they destroyed all of the shuls in Yerushalayim. Of course, the Churva was destroyed, but there were 50 plus shuls which were destroyed, and being emptied of Jews, there was this bleakness. Today we don't think about it as much because Baruch Hashem, living post 1967, where we had the tremendous zechus of witnessing the recapture of Yerushalayim, we forget about the 19 years beforehand of emptiness of any prayer in the old city. What a terrifying thing. And in the great detail describes, you know, the Yama of Shlomo, it describes the poles, the supports, the copper, the sipim, the machtos, the mizrakos, the siros. It's almost in the same detail, not to the same degree, but almost in the same detail as we see when Shlomo Melech built the Beis HaMikdash, and now it's all being destroyed. It takes a very little time to destroy things. It takes a long time to make things. The next section from Chof Dalet to Chof Zayin describes how Nevuzadron, who is obviously the Rav HaTavachim, who's the, you know, in charge of the army, takes a lot of the dignitaries, the spiritual dignitaries, Saraya Kohen Arosh, the head Kohen Saraya, Tzifania, Kohen HaMishnah, second in command Kohen, then the Shomrei Asaf, the guard of the gates, and then he took a whole bunch of the Kohanim, the Sofer Saratzava, he took it and all the way to Rivlah, and he murdered them there. Which is in front of the Melech. Very terrible description. It reminds me, although this is not the exact same story, but the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Dat Tzadi Vov, says that when Nebuchadnezzar entered the temple, he saw that there was blood boiling on the floor. And that was actually the blood of Zechariah HaKohen. Zechariah, as we saw earlier in Tanakh, was a priest, not Zechariah HaNavi. He's going to live later on. And he reprimanded Bnei Yisrael on Yom Kippur, but people weren't interested in hearing his words, and they stoned him and killed him on Yom Kippur in the precinct of the Beis HaMikdash. What a terrible, terrible crime. And ultimately, his blood boiled to the point of Wood Zadron saw it. So he tried to appease the blood, so he shechted animals, and it didn't go down. And then he started killing people one after the other until he killed hundreds of Kohanim on that spot to try to appease the blood, and the blood would still be boiling. And he turned to them and he said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, do you want me to kill everybody in order to appease this blood and the blood stop boiling? But there was this idea that Nebuchadnezzar himself was so appalled by this destruction of the and this killing, this wanton killing of Zechariah HaKohen, that in fact there was all this murder. This seems to be a separate murder because these people being taken to Rivla. But nonetheless, the notion of the spiritual leadership being completely obliterated, all the years, the investment, the bringing up that went into all these people, gone in one file soup over here. It is interesting, by the way, you can actually visit the kever of Zechariah HaKohen. If you go down into the Harazesim, right next to the kever of Yad Avshalom, where Avshalom is buried, is Zechariah HaKohen. It's one of the two larger mausoleum-looking buildings made out of limestone at the very bottom of the valley. Then the Tanakh tells us the amount of people went into exile. It describes in Chof Ches Telamed that the first wave of Golos was 3,023. And then in the next round, it talks about how there's 832. And then it goes and gives a last number. Very confusing, and Rashi tries to balance this with all the other descriptions in Malachim and so on. And he points out that the first wave is describing about Golos Yehoyachin. That was when Yehoyachin was taken to exile with the people who were around him, which seems to be a small number compared to the 10,000 that was described elsewhere. And the second one is about the Golos of Tzidkiyahu. What you notice in both of these, that the numbers are really exceedingly low. This could mean, because even though Yirmiyahu gave them the option that if you surrender, you'll be taken into Golos and you'll be fine, most people didn't and they were killed, which is really shocking, a very shocking idea. But nonetheless, in terms of mass destruction, probably more people were killed than they were actually being taken to exile. That's what it seems to be. And just as we reach this terrible nadir, this terrible low point, we actually now move into the high point, and that is we close the book of Yirmiyahu, where in the 37th year to the Golos of Yehoyachin, that's when Nebuchadnezzar died, so his son Evil-merodach took over and actually elevated Yechoniah, not Tzidkiyahu, Yechoniah. Yehoyachin, who was elevated in the Golos, and he was placed among all the other people, and he was given special garb, and he was able to eat special food, Ad Yom Mosoi, Kol Yimei Chayav, all the days of his life. Why the special treatment? What's really going on over here? So Ben Hillel points out a very fascinating insight, and that is, if you were to ask Yirmiyahu, who do you think is the future? Who has the possibility and the chance of bringing about resolution over here? Yirmiyahu would answer you, Tzidkiyahu. If Tzidkiyahu, the last king, had simply submitted to Babel, he would have saved the people. They would have submitted, they would have lived under Babylonian dominion, and they would not have been destroyed. The Beis Hamikdash would have still stood. That's what Yirmiyahu put his stock into. Even to the last moment, he said that to Tzidkiyahu HaMelech. But when you ask him, what about Yehoyachin? Yehoyachin, he dismissed him. Perikov Beis, he had no interest in Yehoyachin. Yehoyachin's gone to Golos. He joked and sarcastically talked about the way he and his mother were taken to Golos as a protege of Yehoyachin, his father, who he dismissed as well because of his terrible policies. But the irony is that even the Navi Yirmiyahu was not able to see that the Golos would sprout from the one he dismissed, which is Yehoyachin, because Yehoyachin is going to have a child called Shaltiel, and his child is going to be Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel will be the first governor of the Persians who will return to the land of Israel. So the end of Yirmiyahu and of Melachim ends with, although you may think, and even Yirmiyahu may think, that the journey has ended. The journey has not ended. It's just beginning. With this, we end. And actually, we're going to do one more lesson, one more little learning about the structure and order of Yirmiyahu and Yirmiyahu's personal end tomorrow, just as a conclusion, as an epilogue. In the meantime, have a fantastic day, knowing the great amount of achievement reaching this point.